It's not news to anyone if I say we're living in difficult times. We've been living in difficult times for 40 or 50 years, it seems like, if you have been paying attention to prophecy or if you've been around the church. Difficult times, times that always seem like we think, how can it get any worse? And then we live and we see that there are ways that it can still get more difficult. We see ways that Satan can still continue to pervert God's plan for mankind and pervert mankind as well. And it is difficult. It's hard to make ends meet. The income inequity between most everyone that's actually working for a job and the top 5% gets wider and wider all the time. Certainly living in this society as a Christian is more difficult than it was even a few years ago. We see greed and corruption. We see difficult. We see immorality in one level or another in so many areas of our lives. And we recognize that something has to change. We know as Christians something is going to change. We didn't fall for the presidential slogan, change you can believe in, because we knew that whatever change came wasn't something that we would want to see. And it's certainly proven true. Change isn't something that's foreign to us, the idea that things have to change. Every year, as we celebrate God's holy days, we're reminded that things need to change. That we need to be different than we are as Christians, that the world needs to change. And we come to church every week, and we really generally have that idea reinforced in one way or another, through the messages, many times through the conversations we have. And yet, even though we know all these things, even though we know that we need to change ourselves. We see that in ourselves. So many times we aren't successful. We aren't really changing the way that we know that we would like to. We know what needs to be done, but we don't always get there. Many, many times. I don't know if you ask yourself why that happens. Why so often am I not as successful at the things that I try to do as I would like to be? I certainly do that. I think it's probably part of the way I look at things. But it's a question we should ask ourselves. The Bible talks in Hosea about God's people being destroyed for a lack of knowledge, or failing because of a lack of knowledge. And most of the time, our lack of success is because we either don't know or have forgotten the things that will help us to have success in the things that we try to do in our lives. There have been what were called laws since the 1940s in the churches of God that were designed to lead to success if the Christian followed them. Probably if Stephen Covey wrote the book, it would be the seven habits of highly successful people. Or you would find it probably described a little differently. Principles or rules or laws or habits. Regardless of what they would be called, there are principles that can lead to success, can make success more likely to happen. And we're going to look at those today. We're going to look at those seven, what were called the seven laws of success. Back in the older ages of the church, I guess I'll call it. I don't know that we have a booklet that's titled that anymore. I don't believe we do. Last time I looked, we didn't. But there are rules that apply that can help. And if we've heard them before, I will want you to ask yourselves, can I name them all off? Can I list the seven laws of success in my mind? Can I write them down on paper? Before you start to say, oh, I've heard this before, I don't need to listen to this quite as much because, you know, I know the seven laws of success. Write them down. But for many people, I don't believe you probably have ever had them listed, that you've ever talked about them. And it's something that, even though I probably became aware of them 40 years ago, probably, when I was a young person, I have to remind myself of them. Because it's easy to get out of practice of using them. So that's what we'll do today. We're going to examine those seven requirements, seven principles, fill in the blank of what you'd like to call them. If law seems a little bit too hard for you, then you don't have to call them laws. But they certainly are principles that we should apply. So the first principle of success is that success requires that you set a right goal. Set a right goal. Most of the world lives their life reacting to what happens to them. Not planning their life, not trying to direct their life, but reacting to whatever happens to come. They become victims of circumstance. Fate just wasn't their friend today. A lot of excuses, but they all fall back to not having a right goal, not setting goals in your life. And in every area, whether it's your Christian life, whether it's your work life, whether it's your family life, whether it's playing sports, whether it's learning how to play an instrument, having a right goal is the foundation of success. And I want to be clear about that. These aren't principles that only apply to your life in the church, but to every aspect of your life. They will help you have success. It means looking at your life and seeing what needs to be different. That's the start of that. Setting a right goal, first of all, you have to figure out what the goals in your life should be, and that means looking at your life and seeing what needs to be different. And then choosing to do something about the difference, the different part that you don't like, that isn't righteous. And it's worded the way it is because there's more than just making a goal. You could set a goal of, I want to make $1 million. That's a goal. I could make pretty good arguments that it isn't a righteous goal. It isn't a goal that will lead you to righteousness. The goals for a Christian, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be successful and being able to provide for your family. But the goals for a Christian should all lead to righteousness in one way or another. So there's a couple ideas, concepts that I wrote down that maybe will help you understand whether a goal is right. It's a goal that you should choose. It has to be something that excites you. A right goal has to be something that excites you, something you can get motivated to actually work for. Now, if studying your Bible more doesn't excite you, I can question whether your motivation is right. But you need to get your motivation to the point where you're excited about searching after that goal. And it certainly has to be worth, a right goal is something that's worth working for. It's worth working for. and it's something that that has to be worth taking a good deal of time to achieve. Most really valuable goals aren't goals that you can say today, well, this is the goal I'm going to set, and then tomorrow you've got it filled, and you've completely fulfilled that goal and reached it. Now, sometimes you can set those smaller goals, and those are great. But truly, the big goals, the goals that will change your life and make an impact on your life, generally will take you some time to achieve. Generally will take some time to achieve. I'd like to look at an example of goal setting in the Bible. And we're going to turn to 1 Kings chapter 5 to begin with. First Kings chapter 5, we'll begin reading in verse 1. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon, because he heard that they had anointed him king in the place of his father, for Hiram had always loved David. Then Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the wars which were fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord, my God, has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence. Behold, I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he will build a house for my name.'" Solomon just set a goal. He just stated a goal. "I want to build the house of God. I want to..." There were a number of reasons that he listed, but his goal was, "I want to build the house of God." It was a good goal. I mean, we all know that that is a righteous goal. There's actually parallels in our own lives in building the house of God personally and who we are. But it was a good goal. But it wasn't a goal that Solomon was going to achieve the next day. So we skip to chapter 6. We'll read verses 37 and 38. "In the fourth year," after he'd made this proposal, "in the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all of its details." I misspoke myself here, but we'll finish this up. "According to all of its plans." So he was 7 years in building it. So in his fourth year, he made the proposal. He set the goal. And in the 11th year, the house of God was finished. So it took 7 years for that. 7 years to complete the construction. But Solomon, really, his goal wasn't achieved. He'd built a temple. He'd built a house. But who was the house for? It was for God. He still hadn't really had any evidence that it was going to be the house for his God. He'd built a building at this point. And even the work of the temple, of putting the temple together, wasn't completed. He completed the building. And then let's read some more in chapter 7. We're starting in verse 51. "So all of the work that King Solomon had done for the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things which his father David had dedicated, the silver and the gold and the furnishings, and he put them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. And Solomon assembled," continuing in chapter 8, "Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all of the heads of the tribes, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the city of David, which is Zion." So they got all of the gold. All the furnishings were together. And they had the house decorated in a way that they believed was appropriate to worship God, the great God. And they were ready to bring the Ark of the Covenant up, which signified God's presence. It's where God's presence was for Israel, was at the Ark of the Covenant. And then we'll jump to verses 10 and 11 of chapter 8. This is where we see that Solomon actually had evidence that he had reached his goal. And it came to pass, verse 10 of chapter 8, when the priests came out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. God's presence came into that temple, that building that Solomon had built. That's really when he knew that he had achieved his goal, that he would build a temple fitting and worthy for God to place his presence here on earth. That had to give Solomon an incredible sense of satisfaction, because it was a right goal, because it took so long to achieve it, because he was successful in it. And there are other examples. If you look at the Bible through this lens of principles of success, you'll see other times where people of God apply that principle, at least. Setting a right goal. That is that first principle. The second principle is that success requires preparation or education. Success requires education and preparation. True success doesn't just drop in your lap. True success is the product of work, of preparation, of study, of learning, of educating yourself. God didn't make mankind to just rely on instinct. He didn't make us at the same level as animals. God didn't program us so that we would do the same thing in the same way over and over and over again, which is the way the animals are designed to live their life. God expected us to change and to grow and to react. The way that we do that, the way that we prepare ourselves for that, is through education. Many times gaining very specific knowledge about whatever it is that you've set your goal. How to do it. How have other people been successful? What are the problems I'm going to face? What knowledge do I need to have to actually achieve this goal? And then going and working to get that education in one way or another. Education of this type doesn't just come from going to school. It isn't just from book learning. Although sometimes that is what you need. Sometimes going to the library or going online and downloading a book that somebody wrote about the subject is the best, one of the great ways to get educated. But education comes from many different ways. It comes from experience for many of us. And learning from the experience of others. Your family, your friends, the people in church are a great source of education for all of us when it comes to reaching goals. Asking someone, what do you think about this? How do you think I should go forward? How did you become someone who seems to have reach this goal that I'm trying to reach? What did you learn along the way? And just as with setting goals, there's a right type of education and a wrong type of education. The Bible has had a principle that someone who didn't know how to manage their money became a slave, actually, to someone who did know how to manage money. With the idea that you would be taught right principles by that person. The law didn't say, well, you know, I'm going to make you a slave to someone who has thrown away all of his life savings because that's where you're going to learn the right ways to manage your money. The principle was that you work and spend time with someone who has demonstrated success in this area. You can be educated in a way that is morally wrong. You know, I talked about the idea of setting a goal, I'm going to make $1 million in my life by the time I'm 30, whatever that goal would be. You could go those of you that like movies, you could go the Wall Street route, run over everybody, lie, steal, cheat, do whatever you needed to reach that goal of $1 million, and it wouldn't be righteous. You wouldn't get the right education by going to someone who uses those methods. It would be the wrong way of getting education. An education is such a blessing. The ability to learn is something that I will say is a human quality of all of the creation. Animals can be trained. Animals can be programmed. But there's a vast gap between what an animal can be trained to do and the way a human can learn something. And it's really one of the primary ways that mankind is like God. Because God learns as well. And I think that's a point that's missed many times, that God still learns. And you probably are saying, well, I don't know if I buy that even when you're up here saying it. But there is a scripture, of course, that we're going to look at that I think will show that that's the case. Turn to Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5, and we'll begin reading in verse 5. So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he, the Father, who said to him, "You are my son, today I've begotten you." As he also says in another place, "You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek," who in the days of his flesh, when Christ was in the flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear, though Christ was God's son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he had suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him, all who obey the Father. Christ learned obedience by the things that he suffered as he was in the flesh. Part of the reason that Christ had to come as a human being and live as a physical creation was so that he could learn what it was like as a physical human being to obey God, try to obey God. In his case, perfectly, the rest of us, imperfectly. Christ was God. Christ was God before he took on human form, took on human flesh, before he was born. He was God afterwards, and yet he had to learn. He didn't know what it was like. He's the mediator because the Father doesn't know as intimately as Christ knows what it's like to live the way we live. It's what that scripture really says, that he learned. Education isn't something that I don't believe education is ever going to end for us. It won't end when we're changed to spirit beings. It won't end when we receive that first assignment in the millennium. And it's a shame if we allow ourselves to get out of practice of learning now as a human so that we have to learn it again when we become spirit. Education is important. Education is required to achieve success. Education was required for Christ to be a successful mediator. And it's going to be required for us to be successful children of God, sons and daughters of God. Always education is going to be important. So that's the second principle, is getting a right education, being prepared. Prepare yourself to seek after that goal. The third principle that helps achieve success, helps you achieve success, is maintaining good health. Maintaining good health. You know, when you're young, generally you're healthy, and you never think about how it would be, what it's like when you ache, when you cough, when your knees hurt when you get up, when you start making noises when you get up out of the chair because things are stiff and sore. All of us were young at one point, and we never gave a second thought, probably most of us, to our health. It becomes important when you don't have it, or it's something you have to work for, to maintain. But good health is required to have the energy, to have the mental faculties, to achieve success. And poor health makes success a lot harder. I won't say that poor health means if you have poor health, you cannot succeed in different areas, but it makes it incredibly hard to do many times. And none of us are going to have perfect health, but we can all do things to give ourselves better health. I'm sure of that. And as we talk about success and establishing a pattern of success in our lives, maybe a lot of us need to set one of those first goals of getting ourselves into better health than what we are right now. Success requires strength, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And when we talk about good health, it isn't just physical health that we're talking about. Strengthening our mental health, strengthening our emotional health, strengthening our spiritual health is important. All of those are important if we really want to strive for success. And when you have poor health, when something is really causing you problems, it's hard to focus on anything other than that. It always jumps back up there and jumps into your field of vision. And it's standing there saying, hey, you might want to do this, but I'm going to make you look at me right now. I'm going to make you think about me right now. There's a very old saying that you are what you eat. You are what you eat. And it's true. Very true. What we take into our bodies has a good deal, not the only say, but a good deal of say in our health. And God certainly gave some guidelines for what we should put and take into our body. I'm not going to give a message on the laws of clean and unclean meats. I think most of us, if not all of us, are very aware of what those laws are, what those principles are. But are we really living by them? Are there times where we slide a little bit? Where you cheat a little bit? Where maybe you say, well, that isn't that important. That isn't a salvation level issue. What you eat is going to affect who you are, how much strength you have. And they certainly are God-ordained laws for us. You can write Leviticus chapter 11 in your notes if you haven't looked at those laws in a while. It might be a good idea to read through those. And know that, and I just thought about this, I didn't write it in my notes, but know that in one of the minor prophets, God says, anyone who eats swine's flesh will not be in my kingdom. So if you don't think it's a salvation level issue, then maybe you need to look at the whole Bible. Because it is a salvation level issue according to God. God designed certain animals and certain foods, certain things for man to eat so that our bodies would function properly, so that they would work the way that He designed them to. And when you look at the characteristics of the animals that He says to not eat, most of the time it's very obvious when you look at them why. Either the way that they digest food doesn't digest food properly or doesn't filter out pollutants properly, or they eat pollutants. And that is essentially that principle behind all of those foods that God says to eat or not to eat, because He knows what He designed. But I think in the world we live in, there's probably a little extrapolation of those principles that we also have to consider. Because there's a lot of food that technically, by the Bible, I guess you could say is fit to eat. But when it's loaded with chemicals, loaded with pollutants, loaded with preservatives, loaded with all of the things that mankind has put into our foods, it's worth asking ourselves how much of that is really fit for consumption as well. Now, I'm certainly not someone who you're going to see just, you know, picking whatever I can find off on the side of the road, and all fruits, all healthy fruits and nuts. I don't do that. I'm not saying everyone should do that. But I'm saying that the processed foods, the things that mankind has processed in some way or another, aren't as good for us as what God creates. And our health will be better suited if we minimize those things and eat healthier foods, even within the things that are technically all clean. So it comes down to education. Educate yourself on what foods, how the foods that you're eating, where they come from, and what they do to your body, what those chemicals can do, and decide whether they should be something you use that much, you eat that much. And there's certainly other aspects of health besides just what you eat. Getting enough sleep, which in this society seems to become a harder and harder problem, the amount of sleep that you get has a huge impact on your health, on your mental processes, on your emotional state. And I'm one that's, I always violate that principle. Always. I rarely get as much sleep as I should. But I'm sure that my health in one way or another suffers for it, too. Getting exercise is another aspect of being healthy. Being clean, cleanliness is another aspect of being healthy. Getting rest, relaxation is an aspect of being healthy. I think part of the reason we have the Sabbath every week is because if no other time in our life, if we keep the Sabbath the way that God intended us to keep the Sabbath, we have that rest and that relaxation. We have that opportunity to step back and let our mind relax a little bit. So, good health. As I said, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, good health is an important key to being successful in the things that we choose. The fourth aspect of success, requirement of success, is having drive. Drive. Pushing yourself. The ability, the willingness to push yourself to achieve your goal. I said before, most success, true success, doesn't just fall into your lap. Most true success comes from hard work. Is that the 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration quote? Is that what that's about? I think that's where that comes from. Drive. I found I think it's funny saying related to this that I'll share with you. Someone, I can't even attribute it because I couldn't find out who said it. They said, even a dead fish can float downstream. Even a dead fish can move, can float downstream. but it takes a live fish to swim against the current. How much of our life do we spend just like a dead fish, just floating along, wherever the current of life takes us? Because it's easier. It's a lot easier to just drift along. It's a lot easier to not resist. But in this case, resistance is not futile for you Star Trek lovers. Resistance is what we need to do. Drive means doing something with a purpose. It's not just pushing yourself for, you know, and jumping from here to here to there to there. But again, using that goal that you've set, using that education that you've achieved, using your health, and then pushing yourself toward that goal using all of those things. It's your heart's desire. At its source, drive has to come from your heart. Intellectually, you can push yourself for a while. If you know something is what right, is worth it, you can be stubborn for a while and say, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to do this. But if it isn't coming, doesn't eventually come from your heart, the desire to achieve that goal, you'll give up. You'll get tired. You won't value it. You'll let something come in the way. It has to come from your heart. Let's read. We probably are still in Hebrews. Let's go to chapter 12. We'll read verse 1, I think a familiar scripture probably. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Put aside the distractions. Put aside the things that get in the way. And run. Run for what you want. Paul didn't say, just wander along, take your time, be out for an evening stroll, and it'll eventually come to you, whatever it is you want. He said, run. And I think a lot of times that running, certainly on a spiritual level, is one of the things that we lose along the way. New members, new people, recently baptized people, run. They're excited. They chase after what they see is something worth chasing. And then it gets old. I've been in the church a while. I don't really need to run. I don't really need to have that same zeal. And we miss. We lose the drive. And Paul said, therefore we also run. Because he had just listed in chapter 11 a number of faithful examples of faithful Christians. People who had run. And Paul recognized them because they did that. Because they had drive toward whatever goal it was that they were seeking. You think about some of those, we won't read chapter 11, but most of you are familiar with the examples. It says, by faith Noah built an ark. He had to work. He had to work a lot harder than Russell Crowe did in that last movie. He had to work for years and years. He had to drive and push himself in the face of everyone around him saying, you're an idiot. How stupid are you? If he was alive now, they'd try to put him in an insane asylum. You know, he's obviously lost something. By faith, he prepared an ark. He did what God told him to do, right? Didn't say, I should think about that a little bit. He just did. He drove himself to whatever God told him he should do. Abraham is listed in there, moving his family from where they were comfortable, what they knew about, because God told them to. told him to. He did something. All of these examples of faith, if you look at them, are people who did something. They didn't just sit in their tent or sit in their city. They did something. They had drive. Turn to James. We're not too far from there. James chapter 1. James chapter 1, we'll read verse 25. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work. And this one will be blessed in what he does. The person who does something is the person who's blessed. It isn't just the person who comes up with a good idea. You know, I realize I should change. I hope it happens somewhere along in my life. Hopefully God leads me to change. It's the doer who has success. We all have to be doers in one way or another in our lives. And we all can find things in our lives that we should be doing. We probably can find a lot of things in our lives that we should be doing. And that's where setting those goals comes into play. Picking the focus of where you should be doing things. Ecclesiastes 9:10 is almost what I would say should be a memory verse. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. Whatever goal you choose to set, do it with all of your might. Push yourselves. Those people who have drive, those faithful, didn't make excuses for why they couldn't achieve the vision that they had. Now they trusted in God, just like all Christians should, but they didn't make excuses if they didn't have success immediately. They continued. So are you self-motivated? Do you have drive? If not, that's one of those things that we'll need to apply the seventh principle that we'll talk about later on in our lives to, so that we can have some help in becoming that kind of a person. So we've talked about four principles, four ways of living that will help us have success. Setting the right goal, educating and preparing yourself, maintaining your health, driving yourself in the pursuit of your goal. Those are actually all pretty good all by themselves, just those four. Many people in this world apply those and, at least in the world's eyes, do have success. For a time at least. But the last three principles we're going to look at have a lot to do with lasting success. With maintaining that success once you reach it. Because once you achieve success, you'd like to stay there. But there's this principle that we talk about and we laugh about called Murphy's Law that semi-guarantees that things will fall apart at some point or another. Things will become more difficult. Something will happen that you didn't plan on. When you set that first goal, there will something along the line as you achieve that or as you try to maintain that, it's going to come up that you didn't anticipate. Life throws us curves. And that's where this fifth principle comes into play, because that fifth principle of success is becoming resourceful. Becoming resourceful. Learning resourcefulness. Because as I said, there are people who are successful for a while until something happens. Monetarily, there were a lot of people in 2008 that thought they were set for life. They thought, I've got all the money I need, I can retire, I'll be able to do just fine. But they didn't anticipate things that they didn't know. A stock market crash, a depression. Wealth was wiped out, paper wealth was wiped out in a very short period of time. They hit a bump that they hadn't prepared for, and therefore they lost. They were no longer a success in that area. The level of wealth that they had was the example. And many times people give up when that happens. You know, you work so hard to get to that point, and then it just disappears because of something that you didn't think about. And they gave up and they stop running. We see that, I think, all of us in our spiritual lives, where there's times where you just want to give up. And sometimes you do give up for a period because something happened that you hadn't anticipated. But that's where resourcefulness comes in. And I didn't really go to Webster's and write down the definition that Webster's has. I wrote some aspects of it that relate to what we're talking about today that I'd like to share with you. Being resourceful is being able to think calmly in the face of chaos. To maintain a sense of calm when everything around you seems to be unsteady. Being resourceful involves looking at what worked before, what isn't working now, what might be working for someone else right now, and being able to adjust the way that you're approaching this problem. Seeing what worked and what didn't work. Resourcefulness means when you hit a roadblock, you don't just try to beat your head against that roadblock and hope that somewhere along the line you'll beat your way through it. Resourcefulness means looking for a way around that roadblock. Looking at the problem from a different aspect, from a different angle. Many times that means talking to other people. Some people have a natural ability, you know, they'll talk about thinking outside the box. Thinking, you know, being able to approach things from a non-traditional point of view. Some people do that naturally. Many people don't. And the only way that we can do that is by talking to other people, getting other perspectives and see how they would approach it. And then maybe you find the way to get around that roadblock. And to kind of sum it up, resourcefulness is looking at all of the resources that you have at your disposal and finding a way to use those to deal with an unexpected problem. Looking at all of the resources that you have at your disposal. And at the heart of resourcefulness is faith. Faith that there is a solution. That there is a way around that roadblock. Faith that if you apply the principles properly, if you do things the way that you should, there is a solution. Turn to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, we'll read verse 26. Jesus looked at them and said to them, with men, this is not possible. And it doesn't appear to be possible. With men, it is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. We limit, I think, sometimes that statement. We think, well, that would mean maybe healing or something miraculous like that. But that isn't what God says. That isn't what Christ was saying. With God, Everything is possible. There is always a solution that's possible. Now, there are a couple more principles we're going to look at. And certainly, when we're talking about success, it means applying all of those principles. But with God, there is a solution. Always. So, success requires resourcefulness. The sixth principle, success requires perseverance. Perseverance. Paul said in Hebrews 12, the scripture we read, run your race with perseverance. Patience. With patience. Sticking with it. Continuing to run even when your feet can barely lift them. When you can hardly breathe. When every step is a struggle. Continuing to run. Perseverance is a commitment to continue to push on, to continue to drive yourself, to continue to go for that goal. Commitment, perseverance is a commitment to that goal that you maintain. Perseverance is confidence that, again, with God all things are possible. That if you stick to it, if you stick with it, it'll be worth it in the end. It'll be worth it in the end. And perseverance, as I said, is patience. The path to success is it's a lot like growing a tree, growing a fruit tree. If you're going to do it, and you know nothing about growing fruit trees, to be successful, you don't just throw a seed chew up a cherry, spit it out on the ground, and say, okay, I've planted my tree, I'm ready for the fruit now. You apply all of these principles that we're talking about. If you're going to be successful with that, you plant, before you even plant the seed, you have to prepare the ground. Before you prepare the ground, you have to understand what the seed is going to need. You have to educate yourself. You have to get ready. You have to get rid of all the weeds and the sticks and the stones if you want to be successful. Throw the seed. You plant the seed. You plant the seed at the proper depth. You plant the seed in the proper way, where you should, with the proper amount of light and shade. You do all of those things. And then you water and fertilize. And you say, oh, where's my fruit? No. No. That isn't the way it works. That isn't the way it works. You can't even at that point see the beginning of your tree. But you persevere. You continue to treat the ground. You continue to work. You continue to clear away weeds. At some point, eventually, something breaks through the ground. You start to see the beginning of a tree. Have you reached your goal? No. You're only partway there. But you can see that you're making progress. And you continue to tend the ground, and you continue to tend the tree as it grows. And you wait 2, 3, 4, 5 years. In many cases, if you're talking about fruit trees. And then eventually the harvest comes. And you get a reward for your labor. So then you can just forget about the tree, right? Just that's all you have to do. Now you got your fruit and you're done. No. If you want that success to continue, you continue to persevere in taking care of that tree. Taking care of the ground. Taking care of the tree itself. Pruning it. Making it strong to fight off disease. And you continue to apply all of these principles that we just talked about. And you have to persevere. If you give up at any point along the way, that tree won't be as successful, as good, as productive as it could have been. We've talked about six steps, six processes, six laws. There is a seventh, I think most of you that have ever heard these before, would, you know the seventh. You remember the seventh one. But I'd like to go back to that story of Solomon and look at what he did before we really dive into that seventh. Because Solomon applied this seventh principle as well. We're going to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we'll read a number of scriptures here in Ecclesiastes, but we're going to start reading verses 12 and 13 and look at, again, part of the story of Solomon. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, Solomon talking about himself. And I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom, or search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. Solomon said, I want to understand the human condition. I want to understand what life is all about. He set a goal. I want to understand what life is all about. And we'll jump down to chapter 2. We'll begin reading in verse 4. Again, Solomon's still talking about his accomplishments. I made myself great works. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered to myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and the provinces. I acquired male and female singers and delights of the sons of men and musical instruments of all kind. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me. There's an awful lot of I's in those few verses we've just read. I imagine at some point later in Solomon's life, he probably looked at this and said, wow, I had a pretty high opinion of myself, didn't I? You know, we talk about in Ezekiel, I believe it is, where Satan is quoted. How his attitude is shown by the, I did this, I will do this, I will. And that's what we see in Solomon right here. He was only relying on himself at this point in his life. It was his knowledge, his abilities, his desires, his strength of purpose, his power as king that was getting him all of these things and he was calling himself success. In verse 10, he says, whatever my eye desired, I didn't keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all of my labor, and this was my reward for all of my labor. Solomon had gotten off of the track that he had started at as a king. You remember, as a king, one of the first things he did was say, God, I'm not worthy of all this. I need your help because I can't do this on my own. Please give me wisdom. But he lost his way in the course of his life. And I think we start to see that in verse 11, that he was beginning to see that about himself. Verse 11, he said, I looked at all of the works that my hands had done and all the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all of it was vanity and grasping for wind. There was no profit under the sun. There was no point. He said, you know, I did all these things and I'm starting to see that there wasn't any success, true success, lasting success. It wasn't worth it. It was missing something. He was missing something. And success, true success, won't come to any of us if we're missing the same thing Solomon was. And that seventh requirement, seventh principle to be truly successful is maintaining constant contact with God and asking for constant guidance and help from God. Constant, and I'll repeat that, constant contact and guidance and help. Solomon's story does show what happens when we don't have this seventh principle, when we don't include that in our quest for success. It's just as Solomon said, it becomes vanity and without wind, or without profit, striving after wind, if God isn't involved in it. Solomon started out humble. You know, most of the time when we see something that we aren't doing properly, when we see the need to set a goal, we see something we'd like to be successful at, we start out humbly. We ask for help. We ask for people's guidance. We're more than willing. But we have that first taste of success. We have that first vision of what our life could be like if we could have that. And too many times it kind of goes to your head. And you forget the source. You forget your humility. You forget that just like Solomon started out asking God for help, we started asking God for help, and then we forgot that God was the one who helped us. And it becomes we who did these things. And that's where the quest for success will fail for us, is if we forget that, and if we lose that contact. Christ was successful living without sin here on earth, at least partially because he was always in contact with the Father. Always in contact with him. And the more that we can do that, the more that we can maintain that contact, the more likely our success will be in whatever we choose, in anything that we choose. The nice thing about Solomon's story is that he learned. He saw his mistake. And he saw it soon enough in his life that he was able to turn it around. He was able to recognize what really led to success and what was the basis for lasting success. And he told us at the end of Ecclesiastes, and I'd like you to turn to chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, we'll read verses 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. For us talking today about success, let's hear what really is the foundation, what will ensure enduring success. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, everything, including every evil or every secret thing, whether it's good or evil. Focus on God. Keep in contact with God. Follow his commandments. Live your life according to the principles he's laid out. And your chances of having lasting success and true success are multiplied. You could say they're multiplied to infinity, because there really isn't any chance of lasting success without this seventh principle. You can have success on a worldly level with the first six. But I can't say, oh yeah, it'll double your chances of true lasting success. Because if you don't do this, you have no chance of true and lasting success on a God level, truly righteous. How do you define true success? What are you going to do to be successful in the things that you want to do in your life. You need to apply, we need to apply, all seven of these principles, all seven of these laws that we've talked about today. It is a building built on all seven of those principles. And if we neglect any one of those, it's weaker. It's weaker. All of them combined together work the best. You know that you want something to change. I'm sure you do. I'm sure there are areas in your life that you do. True success will come by applying these principles. God created us. God knows us. And He knows what will lead to success. He knows what will lead to success. So we've been given tools. We've talked about them. We've been reminded. A lot of us probably have been reminded of those tools. Some of us probably have never gone over them in this way before. So they're new. They're things to think about. So let's be successful. Righteously. In ways that God would be happy for. But let's be successful. We shouldn't be afraid of that. Apply these principles. Choose true success.